Thank you.
Good evening.
I'd like to call to order the meeting of the Montville Planning and Zoning Commission, June 23rd, 2026. Would you please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, thank you. Roll call, Mr. Secretary, please.
Okay.
Commissioner Lonson?
Molly ain't here.
Okay. Commissioner Terry?
Here.
Commissioner Gillette?
Not here.
Commissioner Pike?
Here.
Commissioner Charge, I'm here. Commissioner Lundey?
Here.
Commissioner Kovalech?
Here.
And Commissioner Summers?
Yeah, I don't think I'm here at all. Okay.
And Commissioner Pinas?
Here.
And is there Mark Myers?
No.
Okay, we got one, two, three, four, six, Nick.
We got a quorum.
We got a quorum, we're good.
Okay.
Thank you. No additions or changes to the agenda this evening. So we're going to move to item 5A, approval of the April 28th, 2026 regular meeting minutes.
Make a motion to approve the minutes.
Okay. I'll second it.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion on minutes? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone oppose? Anyone abstain? Okay, minutes are approved. I will like to entertain a motion to open the public hearing for item 6A. Public hearing, I'll read this first and then we can do the motion and move right into it. Public hearing for agenda item 6A is 26ZC3. Text amendments HB 8002 to multiple sections of the town zoning regulations as a part of the comprehensive rewrite of the regulations being done in part to comply with the terms of Public Act 25-1 of the state legislature, as that act has been codified in various sections of the Connecticut General Statutes. The proposed amendments include, but are not limited to, new format and presentation, amending the definitions of various dwelling types to be consistent with Public Act 25-1, the addition of 4B.16, Table A, residential uses by district to clearly describe permitted dwelling types by district, distinguishing differences between commercial and industrial uses, reorganization of sections for clarity, including grouping of definitions by commonality, the addition of definitions to describe dwelling types, clarifying administrative procedures, and adding provisions to allow streamlined permitting and summary reviews, including enhanced staff level reviews, elimination of minimum dwelling sizes, identifying additional items to be required as part of site plan submissions, addressing inconsistencies and vague terms, phrases in the existing regulations, the deletion of Section 9A.1, Housing Opportunity Development Zone, the deletion of workforce housing as this use is addressed in the revisions related to Public Act 25-1, cross-referencing applicable sections by district, clarifying the permitted uses in the Route 32 overlay zone in the application of bulk standards and density requirements, deletion of expired reference to cannabis moratorium, and the applicant is the Town of Montville Planning and Zoning Commission, submitted 5426, data receipt 52626. DRDNA PH public hearing set for 6/23/26, which is tonight. So do we have a motion to open this public hearing?
Motion.
Second.
Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Public hearing's open, and we're going to move to the town planner, land use director, Dennis Gordier. We're all going to move up to the front row so we can have a peek at the
we don't end up with a crack deck.
Thank you, Dennis. It's all yours.
I'll start off. I have prepared remarks, and then I will go through a presentation, not going into every detail of every change, but high level of the substantive changes, and then turn it over back to the chairman for commission questions. Good evening, members of the commission. My name is Dennis Goddard, and I am the Director of Land Use and Development for the Town of Montville. I am pleased to present to you proposed revisions to the Town of Montville's zoning regulations. These represent a third amendment this year, each sequentially intended to modernize our regulatory framework to respond to evolving community needs, market conditions, and changes in land use law. First and foremost, all such revisions, including those before you tonight, are not intended to complicate or protract an application process. Montville enjoys a permissive zoning approach, meaning most applications are permitted uses and subject to a more predictable land use review process. This is contrary to some communities whom often require an onerous or lengthy evaluation, generally by a special permit process. Staff intends to maintain the current regulatory environment in order to balance economic growth with the protection of the community's health, safety, and welfare. Clear, organized, and thoughtful regulations are paramount in ensuring we can accomplish this goal. Tonight is step one. And to provide context for this evening's changes, it is helpful to look back at the work we've completed thus far just in 2026. In January, you approved an adaptive reuse regulation, creating a much-needed flexibility for revitalizing vacant or underutilized lands and buildings. In March, you approved performance standards, which updated our design and bulk requirements. These changes were critical to ensuring better compatibility between land uses, enhancing community appearance, and codifying standards for landscaping, lighting, site appurtenances, for example. And tonight, I'm presenting a more comprehensive proposal. This effort was driven by three primary objectives. The first is administrative maintenance. Staff has been tracking several regulatory inconsistencies over the past few years that required correction. There's an enhanced user experience, so we are moving toward a more professional, organized, and clearly formatted document that is accessible to residents, developers, and staff. In legislative compliance, we are addressing the opportunities and the mandates outlined in Public Act 25-1. Beyond these immediate updates, this proposal aligns with a larger initiatives currently guiding Montville's future. These initiatives aim to establish a clear vision for the town, creating a cohesive, vibrant destination, a place that is desirable to live, work, and play, and one that is inclusive for all residents, regardless of age or income. For instance, the town recently completed the Revive and Renew 163 and 32 study, I should say in the process of completing, or in the final stages of the report. This process was a refreshing experience categorized by a level of robust public outreach likely unprecedented in Montville. The results overwhelmingly demonstrated both a market need and a public desire to create policy that fosters the creation of a town center, as well as nodes that are pleasant and people-focused. Supporting market studies and outreach conclusions have been provided in the record and are part of the exhibits. Furthermore, we have secured a $125,000 grant for developing a housing plan, which is mandated by the Housing Bill 8002 or Public Act 25-1. This plan will evaluate housing options or opportunities in growth areas while further engaging the public and town leadership. Ultimately, staff anticipates this work, along with the Revive and Renew findings, to be incorporated into the Plan of Conservation and Development, which will serve as our guiding document for the next decade. Commencing in July 2026, with the goal date of completion of January 2028, the new POCD will be developed and zoning will continue to be evaluated and amended, building directly upon the foundations of what we are presenting tonight. And to understand why these updates are essential, it is necessary to consider our land use policy history. Montville did not establish zoning until 1970. By then, the majority of our land was becoming developed. and subdivided. While most peer communities had established development controls and comprehensive plans decades earlier, Montville was playing catch-up. This legacy has left us with two persistent challenges. One, a prevalence of undersized or irregularly shaped lots, and two, land uses that occasionally appear random in their placement. It is common for communities in Connecticut and nationwide to adopt zoning to reflect economic shifts, new planning philosophies, and political will. However, while our code has evolved since the 1970s, it has seen very little substantive modernization since December 6th of 1996, so nearly 30 years. We've been working with the same format of a regulation in a lot of the same language. So it's time for a change. And tonight is a significant step to change that trajectory and fostering the creation of a vibrant and robust destination that we have been working towards. I will now ad lib through some of my the changes. As I said, I'm going to touch upon at a high level. I'll give you a warning. This is really exciting. In all honesty, it is dry. I will give you that warning. But I'll do my best to keep it exciting, and to keep it moving along. But you can see here a slightly new change in what this looks like, and you know that slide on the right-hand side from 1996 is what our current regulations look like right now, just to give you a sense. So, and every page is just as exciting to look at as well. So, we're also trying to create that look as well as the information that is within the text itself. From a housekeeping standpoint, all the necessary notices and referrals have happened. This application was received on the 28th. It's been filed on the land records, with the town clerk's office as required on May 6th, and I know there's been a few people that have come in to take a look at it at the clerk's office. Necessary legal notices have been published in the day on June 10th and recently on June 17th, and referrals to DEEP, COG, and the adjacent towns have been sent out. No town has replied. We did receive response from COG on the 12th saying no adverse intermunicipal conflicts, which is their general statement and what's required, and it was determined to be consistent with coastal policies by DEEP. So all referrals were positive. Some of the highlights from Public Act 25-1 that really started and kicked this change off. It was signed by the governor in November of 25. It is in the record as an exhibit for context. The regulations created a number of new tools, from funding opportunities to addressing our mandated requirements for obtaining our 10% affordable housing requirement. So there's new mechanisms if you have certain zoning in place to achieve that 10%, as well as new housing typologies, which we've talked about in the past, and I'll cover those again a little bit later. One item that has been much discussed in the planning world at the staff level is that middle housing, or housing in general, is now required to be as of right or summary review in commercial districts and mixed-use districts. We already allow that anyways by summary review. It's not new for us, but it's new for a lot of towns, so we've been one step ahead. So we've been very permissive, and the intent, as I mentioned, is to remain permissive as we move forward. Formatting, I've already talked about, ease of navigation with some clear table of contents so people can find items. But getting more into the changes themselves, the preamble, while it's kind of dry and a little, glossed over most instances, but it's important from a court's perspective and when looking for precedent and why you have your regulations and how you apply your regulations. The courts will often go back to your preamble. So we added a few items here to enhance this section. The first is the use of land in accordance with the comprehensive plan in consideration of the plan of development and designed to lessen congestion on the streets. The second one is important in as we move forward to change the appearance of the community. To promote cohesive site landscape and architectural design compatible with the vision of the town, each zoning district, and adjacent neighborhoods. So this is where we start getting into design standards in the future. And to encourage the most appropriate use of land throughout said town and amend such regulations as may be necessary to achieve the goals and objectives of the town's comprehensive plan. It's a little bit redundant. Some of the other changes, street classifications had its own section, number two, and all it said, and you can see in the top right-hand corner in black where it says section two street classification referred to Town of Mottville Road Standards and Improvement Details. That was all section two, the whole section number taken up for just that one line. So we got rid of it, we incorporated it into section 4A, but we also added that the town engineer and director of public works will have flexibility to modify any of the roadway standards on a case-by-case basis for subdivision design or other types of roadway. We don't necessarily always have to have 40-foot wide ride, you know, driveways, and you know that's not necessary from an appropriate from an environmental standpoint. And then definitions took the place of that section and became its own. It was buried in section one prior. And as was mentioned in the notice, definitions are now categorized by theme. People go to each idea of, or each category to find the items that they're looking for. And we'll get into some of the precise definitions in a moment. We also got into how we use certain terms in the regulations. This is something common nowadays in regulations and how the terms will, shall, and must are used and that they are required and versus may or should, and that they're a little bit more on the permissive side. I think we very rarely use those terms. They're all kind of black and white to some degree. We get into saying and talking about buildings versus structures, which we'll get into more detail in a moment. We added references for defining terms if they're not in our definitions and there's a discrepancy or disagreement between an applicant and staff or the commission. We've laid out using Merriam-Webster's dictionary, Black Law's dictionary, or Plano's dictionary as reference points for going back to find a common ground. Building and height terms. We've had a very onerous structure definition, which is really what started this. It just referenced the building code. That really did very little to do with zoning. The more common application of a structure, so I am going a little out of sequence here, so I'm starting on the bottom there on the right-hand side, but it sets the context of everything else. You know, a structure is basically anything attached to the ground, you know, a sign, a wall, a building, or a house, flagpole, or water tower. You know, it's basically, it can be inhabited or may not be something that can be inhabited. A building is a structure, but it's intended to be inhabited by a person or animal. So all bottom line is all buildings are structures, but not all structures are buildings. So we also got into clarifying the definition of the building height, which was very vague and limited, but we're now set consistency where buildings are measured from every corner of the building a prescribed distance away, 10 feet, and from the average grade around the building. So using the average grade is a common. In this case, it's kind of it's been more on the discretionary side, and we have taken into consideration spires, steeples, elevator, stair towers, et cetera, to provide some flexibility so that way people don't get trapped into requiring a variance for some little technicality like that. In this item, so housing-related terms, has probably seen the biggest change. We've added a number of number of definitions because Housing Bill 802 has is very specific on what a duplex is, cottage cluster, townhomes, triplexes, quadplexes, perfect sixes, and live-work units. So we've defined each one of those. I have examples in a minute. So we've added all of them. We've also added a definition for median income or area median income, which references back to American Community Surveys and the Department of Housing. This is important when we get into the set-asides, which we'll talk about in a moment, and any other affordable housing requirements that the state may in the future impose upon the town in meeting its requirements. Define set-asides, where set-aside is a deed-restricted unit under the meeting the median area income and under the requirements of 830G. And then here are examples of the new housing styles that are considered transit middle housing: cottage clusters, which are basically a single family home, a grouping of them organized around a common space in the upper right hand corner, duplexes, which are pretty straightforward, two units side by side, townhomes, I think are pretty straightforward too. We used to group townhomes as multifamily, and your traditional apartment buildings would be multifamily, but now they're all distinguished separately from one another right now in this proposal. So a townhome, you'd walk in the front and you'd be able to walk out the back. That would define a townhome. And you have the attached single family flats is what we're calling them now, which is your traditional apartment building. We have one or a few common entrances into one building, and each unit is accessed by an interior common corridor. Triplexes, three units stacked on top of each other with one common entrance. Quadplexes, so basically, I wouldn't say it's a duplex. It almost looks like a duplex, but it's one common entrance servicing four units that are two units on one floor, two units on the second. And then the perfect six is a three-story building, two units per floor. I think those three are more common probably in urban settings, like a Hartford or New Haven or Bridgeport, New Britain. In multifamily housing developments, there's a specific definition in that it is a mixture of all of these units put together. Traditional neighborhood design, which has been around for about the last 15 to 20 years, it's gotten pretty common, providing a mix of products on a common ownership type scenario. It could be a single family lot, it could be a single family home, it could be a duplex or a townhome. They might all be in one development, and that would be a multi-family house, and it provides housing diversity for a developer when they're selling it, and also to meet the market demand as well, so it's not uncommon. We've gotten into now specifically defining what uses mean, and where this comes from has to do with a couple of things. One, in our C1 and C2 district, which are commercial districts, solely commercial districts, we have the everything for profit is a permitted use, and then in the overlay zone, we say that any commercial use that is permitted in the town of Mottville is permitted in the overlay zone. But the definition of commercial use is extremely vague. Currently, we define it, which is struck on the last sentence here, a use facilitating the barter, sale, or exchange of things of value. It's very vague, can mean a lot of different things. We are proposing a very definitive commercial use definition, which is common in the planning industry, versus the industrial use right below it. This is the only definition. These are the only two definitions I'm going to read for the record. So commercial uses: an establishment involving the exchange of goods or services directly to the end consumer or patron. That's to distinguish it from being a wholesale type use, where we allow currently wholesale uses in industrial districts, not in commercial districts currently. includes such uses as retail, office, personal service establishments, professional services, and hospitality, excludes parking areas and interior, exterior storage, or principal use. Infrastructure type uses such as water towers, solar arrays of any capacity, generators, pump stations, substations are not considered commercial use. Industrial gets to be very specific. Bear with me for a moment. This use can vary in intensity and often requires unique considerations to address noise, light, odor, vibration, traffic generation, or other potential nuisances which may be required to support the use. Uses include manufacture, fabrication, wholesale, chemical processing, earth processing, construction equipment storage, textiles, wholesale of goods, assembly, disassembly, packaging, treatment of materials, goods or products, storage, junkyard, scrapyard, recycling, storage or use of hazardous materials, dry cleaning, plating and jewelry, foundries, solid waste, waste reclamation, infrastructure, warehousing, distribution of such products, either interior or exterior of building. Includes technology laboratories, printing and publishing, furniture production, creation of art products such as clay or ceramics, and light assembly where manufacturing of components is done off-premises or similar uses, sort of the catch-all. But it gives both of these, we think, give a very definitive parameter to help categorize a commercial use versus an industrial use. So when someone comes in and says they want to do something utilizing the overlay zone, well, is it a commercial use or is it not a commercial use? This, we believe, is necessary absent the full comprehensive list of trying to identify all of the uses in a matrix, which I had talked to you several months ago, in which normally a regulation would have, and maybe one day we will have that. But generally, you'll have a matrix that lists maybe 100 or more uses. It is very specific. We don't have that. We're not there yet. Maybe we will be. Change of use, I jumped over that. This helps, especially on the zoning enforcement side, when somebody comes in for a permit and needs to get an understanding. So it gives parameters of what would be and would not be a change of use, and it has to do clearly with a change from one category to another versus the intensity of the use, including requiring higher utility loads or greater parking requirements. We already talked about commercial and industrial, retail, and we started defining some specific type uses such as professional services, personal service establishments, and retail. Eventually, in an ideal world, we would recommend having not only the matrix, but a definition for every single type of use too. It sounds monotonous, it sounds like overkill, but from every planner's perspective, uses are always those that become the most challenged from an administrative standpoint. Districts, each section of the district, of the districts in the regulations has been modified to some degree, but Section 3 was simply renamed to just districts. It had a long name, didn't really understand what it meant. Currently it says establishment of district boundaries and scope of controls. We just call it districts now. Here we took the residential districts and we clearly lumped them to say these are our residential districts in our town of Montville. These are our commercial and mixed uses. These are our industrial. These are our special. This is important because Housing Bill 8002 says housing must be as of right in commercial and mixed use districts. It's up to the town to define a commercial or mixed use district. So this is how we're defining our commercial and mixed use districts. Administrative, we've added interpretation of use. So this comes down to If there's, you know, as I said earlier, this is one of those sticking points of, from a staff administrative standpoint, is how you classify a use of being allowed or not allowed in a district. We are simply codifying, clarifying, which is already allowed by law, but that the zoning enforcement officer is the individual that makes that determination. There are zoning permits, which are permits that our ZEO signs off for, which and then do not come before you. We've provided more clarity on what those are. Currently, Ms. Radford has been, you know, has her own list of things that she uses to tell applicants that this requires a zoning permit, this requires a site plan, or this requires a special permit. We now list it, so it's very specific. And then we're just referencing our general statutes for expiration of permits rather than repeating it. So this basically, excuse me. This is the text of what I had just mentioned, so I'm not going to get into all of it. General requirements, which is section 4A, sidewalks was one area that we've had some challenges with of when it's required. There's a little redundancy in this new section, I'll admit, but basically any property that has frontage on Route 32 must have a sidewalk. Every sidewalk must connect to the front door of a building. It wouldn't be fair if somebody's walking to get to someplace. They have to walk through a parking lot all the time, or there's no way to get to the front door. There should be a nice, convenient, safe way for a pedestrian to get to the front door of a building. All buildings on a site must be connected by walkways as well, so people can get from one destination to another. And then anything located within properties located within 1,000 feet of existing commercial centers, schools, or places of public gathering would require a sidewalk. People say it's not going to connect to another sidewalk. Well, that's the whole point. Eventually, each property will have a new sidewalk, and then it will be connected. Extensions into setbacks. We currently allow extensions into setbacks, but no more than 36 inches. That is often in conflict with building code because you might need more in order to get a turning radius at a door or, for the landing, et cetera. So we are allowing extensions into a setback only for existing structures, and it would be the minimum necessary for the building code. And then we've added a section for 4A11, accessibility and accommodations for persons with disabilities, referencing which building codes are applicable for design. The last one, public rights of way and accessible guidelines, is fairly new in the last few years, and it covers exactly public rights of way. So sidewalks in the public rights of way, or parking, on-street parking, multi-use trails. Should we be fortunate enough to have some in the future, PROAG would be the governing regulatory reference. Use-specific standards, briefly here, multifamily is now middle housing. There was a really interesting requirement that a multifamily building, the full front facade had to be parallel with the street. So, you know, you had a building 100 feet long, or the gable end couldn't, you know, face the street. So that is very restrictive from a planning standpoint, especially if you have a deep, narrow lot. You technically should get a variance for that currently. This gets rid of it. I've never heard of it. I've seen lots of multifamily regulations, but it stifles creativity. We cross-referenced the new landscape and lighting such standards in Section 18 through E, I think it is. One element to call your attention to, earth processing. Our regulations just said a property survey and a T2 or T3 boundary or a topographic survey. It's been revised to say an A2 boundary survey, and also it's been revised to specifically say T2 because all of our site plan applications require both an A2 and a T2 survey. Earth processing and excavation can be an intensive use on a site, can go up closely the property line, so we want to make sure that we have the accurate information at our disposal. And we deleted workforce housing, which is no longer necessary because of Housing Bill 8002. One of the notable changes is the creation of a matrix for residential uses. This is, to address all the housing bill elements and the specific housing typologies. We've also included senior housing, adaptive reuse, and manufactured homes on this table. You can see, you probably can't read the text, but on the left-hand side, the vertical column in the light blue, that's the building type. There's a cross-reference to the section of the regulation that if that building type might have a specific standard to follow, it's cross-referenced for ease. And then across the top is each of the districts. So it's basically a matrix, go over and go up to find your district, and then find the requirements that are associated with it. Those requirements are on the left half of the table, identifies which uses are permitted, prohibited, or permitted by special permit. So anything that's red is prohibited, the green is a permitted, and then in the yellow is specially permitted. And then in the browns or beiges are either they're specially permitted with some conditions, and that's only for the adaptive reuse. The overlay zone is all of the residential uses are permitted by if you utilize the overlay zone, with the exception of the single family house, the clustered development, or manufactured home parks. The manufactured home parks, I just want to mention, has not changed. They have always been allowed by special permit in the 120, the 80, the 40, and the 20, and they remain as such. On the right-hand half of the column is the density. So there had been some inconsistencies with defining multifamily density. So we've created a table. Let me pull it out. So each typology has its own density by district. I'm not going to read each one of them, but I do want to make mention that the multifamily housing, which if you look at attached single-family flats, which are your traditional apartment buildings, are generally 20 units per acre, which is a slight increase from 18 units per acre into the current regs. So we have what I think are very generous numbers up to 30 units per acre for some of our unit types. And then they go down for the lower density type units, such as duplexes, triplexes, or quadplexes. A new requirement, which we had talked about, and it was the commission's decision to maintain, is to require a set-aside, meaning an affordable housing component would be required with any of these housing types, with the exception of single-family houses in cluster developments. Right? Let me see. Correct. Yes. So 10%, so there's a tiered approach, which is the very furthest right-hand column, which I know you can't read, but it's a schedule of up to 19 units. There would be no set-aside required. Anything up to 50 units or would be 5% of the subtotal. And then anything over 50 units would require 10%. So there's a tiered approach depending on the amount of units you're proposing. We also included open space requirements in this table as well, which we had been requiring, I think, only a 10% requirement, but we have added maintained 10% throughout. There's a couple that require 15%. On the set-aside, the reason this is important, not only because of the housing crisis throughout, but we are also mandated by the state through the Affordable Appeals Act to have 10% of our housing stock set aside as affordable. Currently, we are at 6.38%, so we are short. So we are subject to 830G appeals, so somebody can come in with an 830G application, bifurcate all of our zoning, and build at any density that they so desire, at any type of design standards that they so desire as well, which isn't always necessarily a bad thing. It can be scary for some, but our percentage has hovered between, I look back today to 2002, it's hovered between 4% and 6%. This is probably the highest it's been in the last several decades, in part because of OXLABOX. So loft bumped us up substantially, almost a percent from 2024. And we anticipate, from indications that we've been receiving, that the state will be mandating every town to meet a certain affordable housing criteria threshold. So that 10% might change. I'm not sure how it's going to work. I'm not really in the know on all that. But when we start developing our housing plans, at some point, they're going to tell the region, the state's going to tell each region how many housing units the region needs. And then the region's going to tell the town how many numbers they need. Somewhere along those lines. That's somewhat of the process that I understand it. I just want to take a moment on affordability. I had provided this to the commission a couple of months back. This is a table. It's probably hard to understand if you haven't seen it before, and I prepared it so I understand it. But this looks at income, both at the HUD area median income, which is the top part. You can see where it says HUD in orange on the left. And then there's the work, what I'm calling workforce housing. I looked at the contracts for Montville PD, fire, and teachers. So each of the different pay grades, you can see what the salary is. 30% is the maximum ideal amount used for towards housing costs. So for either rent or your mortgage, that's that third column from the left where it says 30% monthly salary. The bedroom, one bedroom, two bedroom, and where it says three bedrooms, those amounts are the average rents in town. The source from that is BGH Advisors from their research on the market study. So a one bedroom rent on average is $1,100 a month in Mottville. And where you see the numbers in black, that's the difference of leftover money for that specific salary scale that's on the left. So bedrooms, one bedroom and two bedrooms are for the most part affordable. You can see for some pay grades, they are there's an imbalance. So those people, if they are renting a two bedroom, they would be considered cost burdened. You can see across the spectrum, a three bedroom apartment is not affordable. And that also, if you look at the American Community Survey on the bottom, where it just says Mottville in orange on the left, a family. Which is one individual, at least one individual living with another relative, earns an average salary of about $111,000, and you can see where that falls on fairly affordable for a one- and two-bedroom rental. A married, which is a couple with or without children, and a household includes everybody, including individuals that are singles that may own a house. So generally, we're an affordable community, but we're not obtaining the credit for that. By the way the state laws are written, you cannot, there's no mechanism to obtain credits for naturally occurring affordability. So you need to do that through deed restriction. So that's why the regulations that we are proposing include the deed restriction requirement. And there's, I already touched upon the Affordable Appeals Act. This just goes back to 2019, and you can see our numbers varied from 5.3 to where we are now at a little over 6%. And the bottom shows the cost burden of folks in Mottville, or about just over 10% of renters are cost burdened from 30 to 35%, and then 27% of renters are cost burdened greater than 35%. So that's almost 40% of people that rent in Mottville are cost burdened. There was one change, which I glanced over here. When I was looking back at the regulations, note 4 on this table really did not clearly distinguish the requirement of the set-aside, so I'm proposing that this be edited to read, as noted here, total set-aside units are rounded up to the nearest whole unit. All set-asides shall be deed-restricted units as required per 830G unless project financing requires otherwise. However, this section 4B16 set-aside shall be the minimum required regardless of financing terms, meaning in some instances you might be getting under affordable appeals where it says government assisted. These are construction subsidies in most instances, such as what Oxabox-Olof received. Rental assistance are vouchers in Section 8. And then the other way that the state mandates or calculates affordability is through mortgages for single family or townhomes. There was one other one I wanted to bring to the to your attention. I might have missed it too. Or maybe no, that's later. That's right. Zoning districts. Again, we cross-referenced different sections that needed to be cross-referenced for clarity and reinforcing requirements of the regulations, requiring interconnected lots in the more densely developed areas such as the R20M and C1 and C2. This requires easements to allow for future abutting developments to interconnect. So sidewalks between properties or curb cuts between properties so we can minimize the number of curb cuts on streets. And the cannabis overlay had its own landscape regulations. We deleted that and cross-referenced the Section 18 regulations. Building height. Interestingly, in all of the residential zones, we had a qualifier that said residential buildings shall be no higher than 35 feet. So that begged the question that if you had a commercial building, which they are allowed in residential districts, you can have a higher building, a taller building. So we removed residential from that and just said buildings are no higher than what it was noted as. I brought this to your attention. C1 and C2 does not have any building restrictions, so somebody can come in and across the street build a 10-story building as of right, too, no special permit, right? So we're proposing that the C1 have a 45-foot building height, which is generally a 3 to 4 story building, and the C2 have a 55 building height, which is generally a 4 to 5 story building. That all depends on the construction, the floor-to-floor requirements, mechanical equipment, and it also might depend on the roof style. C1, just as a refresher, is your more village-oriented commercial district. C2 is more of your larger scale, more intense commercial districts, hence the difference in scale. And 45, I think, is probably generous for a village-type setting, but can still be done appropriately. We had to, because we have the different unit types, dwelling unit types, some of them have different height standards. For instance, a triplex has to be 3 stories for one unit to be stocked on top of each other for the total of 1, 2, 3. So a triplex building or a perfect 6 would have a maximum building height of 45 feet. The others would be 35 feet. This table is not in the regulations. This was just for tonight's purposes. In the R40, we are now requiring all multifamily, which would be your attached single-family flats and your townhomes, to be done by special permit. This was something I believe we had talked about prior to making final edits to this proposal. This also includes senior housing and active adult and cluster developments would be special permit, as well as manufactured homes, home parks, which I had mentioned earlier on. And this is sort of a catch-all slide, so bear with me. The HOD zone has been deleted in its entirety. Nobody's really clear exactly why it was drafted. We have indication that a developer had proposed it at one time a while back. They never moved forward with it, and it's never been utilized. The C1 and C2 And the current regulations do not allow housing in C1 and C2 zones unless you utilize the overlay zone. This amendment would allow middle housing in single-family attached flats as of right in each of those districts, even without the OZ zone. You have to now because of the housing bill. And I already talked about the summary review or as-of-right review for housing within commercial districts, and we talked about the table. Light industrial, something we talked about at the staff level, was to create, we moved out excavation and processing, which is one use, and then concrete manufacturing as a second use. They're currently allowed as permitted uses. We're suggesting to consider them to be special permits because of the intensity of uses that are involved, that we believe there should be a special level of scrutiny and flexibility with those, especially with our industrial districts, because they are small and they are close proximity to residential. I don't believe that is something we talked about with this commission, but I wanted to bring that up and call attention to that with you. Industrial districts did not have a setback, so we added a 50-foot rear yard setback for residential zones just to create a little more opportunity for a buffer. And government districts didn't have a building height. We've set a cap at 55 feet, and there were no setbacks at all either. We suggested 25 side and rear setbacks and 50-foot. Front yard setbacks. I get it, they're government, they're the town. I guess the question that maybe you want to ask yourselves is, should the town have more scrutiny, or not more scrutiny, more flexibility, or be held to some of the same standards? We're following the same, this follows the same approach for all the zoning districts, to have some level of protection for residents or any other businesses that might be nearby. And even though there are setbacks that are on your property, they also protect that property from maybe a neighboring property too. So they do double duty. The Route 32 overlay zone. The regulation is very, for me, when I first started looking at it, it was very difficult to understand on how it's applied. And I believe often, and Meredith and Stacy will correct me if I'm wrong, but there has just been in a way that it's evolved to and how it's been applied. So what this does is we are creating clarity in text to how it's been historically applied. First, I'm going to start at the purpose. There's a slight change, just to say the intent of the overlay zone is to promote economic development. We added in housing diversity. Housing is economic development, but I think that's, you know, it's trying to accomplish both of those items. There was a very descriptive matter for the location of the overlay zone. We just said cross-reference to zoning map. We don't describe where zoning districts are or anything else in our regulations. The substance changes start at permitted uses. It currently says a mixture of permitted commercial uses and structures and or residential dwelling units may be permitted in the overlay district. That's what it says currently, but if you read it without the strikeout, so it says commercial uses and residential uses are permitted in accordance with Section 17 of these regulations, as follows, which says you have a commercial use, you have a residential use, and this goes back to the definitions that we talked about earlier. You can do them as of right under the regulations of Section 17. So it just cross-references the residential uses per Section 4B16, which that's the colorful table that we talked about. You're allowed to do mixed uses in multiple structures, where before the text just said multiple structures. It didn't say anything about allowing mixed use. We maintain no residential units shall be allowed in basements. We can't regulate the parking, and you cannot regulate minimum park floor area anymore as well, so those were struck. The other element that wasn't codified or in writing but bulk standards and density. It usually reverted back to the underlying zone, even though it wasn't written anywhere. Some people would say that the bulk standards, you can just do whatever you wanted to do, but that wasn't the case. So we are being clear that the bulk standards shall conform with the underlying zone, and that the densities for the residential uses shall conform with the section 4B16, which is the table here. So you can see that first yellow arrow, that's the OZ zone. So in that light yellow color, where it has a P, it says that means that all of those residential uses are permitted as of right. Again, another change I'd like to add for the record is to clarify note one, where it currently, it's referring to the density, and it doesn't clearly identify what the intent is. So the intent is that the density of a dwelling type shall be the density permitted in the underlying zone. I didn't say that. I just said that, I just went straight to that. If it wasn't noted in the underlying zone, then you'd go to the next least dense requirement. So that's a change that I'm suggesting that we make that wasn't in the original application. And then finally, there was a number of changes to Section 17 for site plan. One that we spent some time talking about for decision-making authority. This provides the opportunity for all site plans, period, that aren't special permits to not have to come to the commission. They can just be handled at staff level, and staff can approve them. But we have the discretion to bring them to you on a case-by-case basis. And then deviations, this one allows an applicant to deviate a certain requirement by up to 15%, either increase or decrease, depending on the situation, in following certain criteria. So that way it gives some flexibility for either setbacks, if there's a need to reduce a setback, or change a parking stall size, because it doesn't have to necessarily always be like maybe 9 by 20 or 10 by 18, but it provides that flexibility and not having to go directly for a variance. But anything beyond that flexibility would have to go to a variance. If somebody is asking for a deviation, it would automatically come to you for your judgment on that. We've been requiring electronic filing in different formats that people will not provide, which is understandable, so we just clarified that it's only for PDF. And there is a litany of items that we have expanded upon in site plan content that we always ask for, but we never given, or not, I shouldn't say never, but sometimes we are not giving them, but we've added them into the regulations, so it's a little more clear on what we're looking for. So that concludes everything, almost everything, but I am more than happy to entertain questions.
I want to go back to your report and seats. Thank you.
So before we go to the public, I'll ask commission members if you have any questions for Dennis. Lisa?
No, I don't.
Wills?
No, I do not.
No, that's right, not. Josh?
The light industrial for crushing and earth removal and processing, what is the purpose of putting that into special permit, even if it's in light industrial?
Can you allow that in the light industrial?
Yes.
Okay. As I had mentioned, that we talked about it at staff level and felt that the earth processing is by noise level, by potential environmental and also dust control or nuisances to nearby neighborhoods, that we felt that it would be for your consideration to place that under as a special permit to allow for a greater level of control by the commission, either to impose conditions or if somebody was proposing an operation that just did not work for that location, and you didn't feel like it was appropriate, then you would have more discretion for denial.
Some of the light industrial abuts residential, yeah, and they're smaller lots, so it may not be appropriate for that, where other light industrial is larger and near industrial or commercial.
And we'll have a discussion about it later. I provided a memo on what conditions of approval are versus modifications and site plans versus special permits. And just because something's a special permit doesn't necessarily mean it's not allowed or isn't going to be allowed. It just allows this commission a higher level of discretion in making a decision. Where under a site plan, it's either, if it meets the regulations, you have to approve it.
Josh, any more?
Nope, that's good.
The only thing I jotted down, and it was on the same two topics. The suggested setbacks and the requirements, you know, for the special permit for that. That'd be the only one item that I would really like to have the opportunity, and I know it's part of your plan with our POCD to create a big picture map of where our light industrial and existing industrial spaces are. And I think before we include these two, I'd like to really look at that and see how they're situated and how they affect the abutting zones that are next to them before we decide on that. That would be my only.
Are you talking about the 50-foot setback?
The 50-foot setback. You know, how is that going to affect something that's already existing against the residential zone that, you know, who came first? And what's fair in that respect? Because we all know how special permits become public hearings, yeah, become public lynchings, and, you know, there's a lot of influence, and I'm not necessarily a believer that that's necessarily a fair process either. So that's the only thing. Everything else I...
So was it the setbacks and what else?
Yeah, the setbacks and the special permit for the
earth processing,
for the earth processing,
concrete manufacturing.
Yeah,
if we get to a motion tonight, you'll see in the motion there was if this is something that you are going to or entertaining approval, and if that's the consensus of the commission, then you'll need to ad lib into that motion to strike those two items.
Okay. And not that they shouldn't be there.
You know, I understand.
I would just like to have a little more time and a little more overview of where they sit, because I think in the big picture sometimes we struggle as to where we're going to get our light industrial areas and where we can create them. And again, if we're going to create new ones up against residential, I don't disagree, yeah, with you.
And if that's what the commission decides, you know, as I had mentioned, the intent would to have a very close look at all of the uses that are appropriate. It would be our recommendation to create that matrix and to have a more comprehensive look. And I think that would be, that will be one of those items that we want Gohmann and York to take a look at and work with you all on in the near future. So
I just think that'd be good practice there. I think everything else has been given great thought, and we've covered everything. One more time, any questions from the commission before we go to the public? Staff, Meredith, Stacy? Okay. Anyone in the public like to speak in favor of this application? Anyone like to speak in opposition?
Let's be brave.
Anyone like to speak in favor? Anyone like to speak in opposition? Last call. Anyone like to speak in favor of the application? Anyone like to speak in opposition? Okay. Hearing none. Last call. Any other questions from the commission members? Entertain a motion to close the public hearing.
Motion.
Second.
Discussion on the motion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone oppose? Anyone abstain? Public hearing is closed. So, next item is discussion and decision regarding this application that we just heard. Before we make the motion, I'm going to ask each of you if you're comfortable in just omitting the light industrial reference in this. Is that, you want to give me the verbiage you'd like to make that, if we were to delete that, or? Again, I feel it's something we can add after further review.
Mm.
What if we said exception, with the exception of restrictions related to light industrial activities, or the proposed
in the industrial
provisions
in
to,
industrial setbacks,
yeah.
Right?
And that was just the rear yard setback.
Rear yard, okay.
So I'm saying, I was going to suggest that you add with exceptions to 50-foot rear yard setback in industrial zones and maintain earth processing and concrete manufacturing as permitted uses.
Okay. Can we borrow your cheat sheet for a minute?
You didn't know.
Well, I did, but. Thank you, Dennis. Vice Chair Pike, I'd entertain a motion from you with those. Is everyone comfortable with that? Okay.
Okay, I make a motion to approve application 26 ZC3, text amendments, housing bill 8002 to multiple sections of the town's zoning regulations proposed as part of the comprehensive rewrite of the regulations being done in part to comply with terms of Public Act 25-1 of the state legislature, as that act has been codified in various sections of the Connecticut general statutes. The proposed amendments include, but are not limited to, new format and presentation, amending the definitions of various dwelling types to be consistent with Public Act 25-1, the addition of 4B.16 Table A, residential uses by district to clearly describe permitted dwelling types by district, distinguishing differences between commercial and industrial uses, reorganization of sections for clarity, including groups of definitions by commonality, the addition of definitions to describe dwelling types, clarifying administrative procedures, and adding provisions to allow streamlined permitting and summary reviews, including enhanced staff-level reviews, elimination of minimum dwelling sizes, identifying additional items to be required as part of site plan submissions, addressing inconsistencies and vague terms, phrases in the existing regulations, the deletion of Section 9A.1, Housing Opportunity Development Zone, the deletion of workforce housing, as this use is addressed in the revisions related to Public Act 25-1, cross-referencing applicable sections by the district, clarifying the permitted uses in the Route 32 overlay zone and the application of bulk standards and density requirements, deletion of expired reference to cannabis moratorium, and modify 4B.16 Table A, residential uses by District Note 1 to include the statement, density for a dwelling type shall be the density permitted in the underlying zone. And Note 4 shall read, total set-aside units are rounded up to the nearest whole unit. All set-asides shall be deed-restricted as required per 830G unless project financing requires otherwise. However, this Section 4B.16 set-aside shall be the minimum required regardless of financing terms, with exceptions to 50-yard rear setback in industrial zones and
earth processing
and concrete manufacturing as permitted units, effective July 14th, 2026.
Okay, thank you.
I'll second the motion.
Second.
Okay. So we have a motion.
Second.
No,
Lisa second that. Thank you very much. Okay. Any discussion?
Oh, yeah. I got one question.
You got a question.
Okay. Just make sure that's all in the same sheet of music. When they say, let's see where it is. But minimum housing, it said elimination of minimal dwelling size. That means the house can be any size. Like some of you just want to make a little house like that, one room shack.
Where are you reading that?
Okay, let's see. All right, that's one big thing. It says elimination of minimal dwelling size.
Yeah, no. With the changes in the housing bill, you cannot have a minimum housing size.
Okay, that means if they get away with it.
It's governed by building code. Whatever building code requires, you have to follow building code.
Okay. Any other discussion? Okay, let's have a roll call vote.
Okay,
Mr. Secretary.
Okay, let's get that thing together.
You're welcome.
Okay. People are here. Okay, Commissioner Lunch, he's not here. Commissioner Terry.
Favor.
Yes. Commissioner's not here. Commissioner Pike.
Favor.
I'm here. Favor. Commissioner Lundy.
In favor.
Commissioner Kolbulak.
In favor.
Somewhere's not here. Commissioner Pena. Yes.
In favor.
Okay, we got everybody here. Favor.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you.
Great job. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good progress. Okay, we're going to move on to old business, agenda item 7A, which is, for the record, that's yours, 26 Site 2, 888 Route 32, 083-005-000. Freestanding parking lot, the applicant's Joe Pinnell, the owner is Depot Road Property, LLC. And as of right now, there's been revised plans, which were received in the office on the 16th of June. The assistant planner and the town engineer had some additional comments, which have been provided to the applicant and the land surveyor. So this evening, we'd like a motion to continue this until the July 28th meeting.
So moved.
Okay.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Anyone oppose? Anyone abstain? So we will move this to the July 28th meeting. Next item under old business is 7B, 25 sub 7 and 25 SP1, 47 Sharp Hill Road, property description 023063-000. which is a 23-lot re-subdivision. The owner is R&N Holding Company, LLC. This was approved with the conditions on November 18th, 2025. They're requesting for a 90-day extension of time to file Mylar plans to September 2nd, 2026.
So moved. Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Anyone oppose? Anyone abstain? We are... extended to September 2nd. Okay, new business.
Here we are.
8A. Connecticut General Statute A-24 review for a USDA grant application planning study for the Meadows Apartments. Dennis.
Thank you. So this is an 824 review initiated by the mayor and finance director associated with the possible sewer extension, Forest Main, to address a failing on-site septic systems at the Meadows Apartments at 90 and 91 Leffingwell Road. The owner is here and will speak in a moment about this. Right now, this isn't specifically about an impending or immediate improvement to tie into sewer. Rather, this is to support or not support the application of a grant to the USDA. It's called the U.S. Department of Agriculture Water and Wastewater Disposal Pre-Development Planning Grant. For, I guess, several years, as Mr. St. Germain will mention and talk about in a moment, the property has been experiencing many issues with its on-site system, requiring constant pumping, and there's concern with how or whether or not it can even be remediated on-site and addressed on-site. So there has been a request to connect to the town's system. The owner, if I remember correctly, and I have the sequence correct, somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, but the owner had brought this to the mayor's attention that there are grant opportunities with USDA, or somehow just in general conversation it was brought up. We started talking with the USDA of whether or not this is a project that they would fund both from a planning standpoint and also from a capital standpoint and actually fund the construction. We met with them as well as Mr. Ron was with us. I believe Ron, you're here still. Yep. From WPCA. The USDA said, yes, it is something we would fund, but the town would need to be the applicant. The town would need to apply for a planning grant to study the feasibility of this sewer extension. If it is something that's determined to be feasible and that number, we determine what that number is and that cost, then the town could then in turn apply for a second grant to fund the actual construction of that improvement. So the town would be the recipient of the money and the administrator of this. When we were initially looking at this, I raised the question as to the appropriateness only in the context that this is a private development. But then I said, well, is there an opportunity here for the town? We've got light industrial land nearby. A couple of the properties already have permits for development, and they're active. One, I believe, has a 3 or 4 building development on Mr. Petrowski's property. Service station is also nearby. Mm. And then there's a vacant light industrial parcel. Is it Montville Road? Towards Walmart, that side over there. So maybe there was an opportunity also to be gained. So I had suggested that we bring this as an 824 because it is ultimately will be a public improvement if we move forward. So this would be just for the planning grant. This would not be for the actual construction grant money. So this whatever decision that you make to refer it back to town council. And as you probably remember, under 824, if you vote to disapprove this, the commission, the council could still decide that they believe that this is something worthy to move forward with, but they would need to have a supermajority vote to do so. I have not, and we've had discussions, I think it was last week, we met with the landowner. There have not been, to my knowledge, any detailed studies on site as to why an on-site solution can't be done. There very well could be very good observational conclusions that have been drawn. But I think it's important for the commission to hear that directly from the owner and their engineer before you. You'll see that any motion, if there is a motion for approval, I think we need to also understand any implications, long-term planning to the WPCF, so to the facility itself. And maybe this is also an opportunity for us to understand capacity for future development, either whether it's impacted or not impacted by this tie-in, this possible connection. This might be an opportunity to understand what it means for the town and what might need to be done at the Water Pollution Control Facility for any expansion possibilities. The grant isn't a large sum of money. You can obtain up to $65,000 in funding. It requires a 25% match. So that would equate to just over, it's almost $22,000 in matching funds for a maximum study amount of roughly $87,000. So I think, unless you have questions for me, maybe it's more appropriate at this time for Mr. St. Germain and his engineer to talk a little bit more about their need, but I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
You want to hear from the property owners?
Yeah, I think so.
The engineer
first. Yeah, let's listen to them first.
Gentlemen?
Man, give us a spiel.
Good evening. Bob Luka with CLA Engineers. Plan that you probably have in your packet, but
yeah, that should be in your packet. I did include that. I forgot to reference it. Right down there, probably.
And Bob, you can take that microphone off there.
Okay.
I probably should have had it on the screen.
So Bob DeLuca with CLA Engineers, representing Steve St. Germain. This plan was prepared about 6 years ago when Steve was trying to move forward with some type of repair for his residential complex. Residential complex is on Leffingwell Road 90 and 91. There are it is just west of the 395 overpass. There are 18 buildings, a total of 114 units, and 187 bedrooms. Parcel's about 12 acres in size. It was built in 1967, so it's just approaching about 60 years old. We believe, there hasn't been a study done. Our involvement has been pretty recent. Other than producing this plan, we haven't We looked into some of the repairs, some of the soil data. It looks like it's all good gravel in that area. But this was built, I think, 15 years before the technical regs were in place for subsurface sewage disposables. So there probably wasn't a lot of oversight during that time. The regs were in place in 1982. This planning study would determine the need, and if something else can be done besides a connection to the town sewer system. This plan represents a force main connection. That yellow line is a pump station on site with a force main that would connect at the Fitchhill Road, Leffingwell Road intersection, which is about 2,500 feet away. There was talk of also providing, now a force main connection would not allow properties along the route to connect, so we also looked into a gravity connection, which would create a low point around where the service station property is, and then it would be two gravity legs that came down and connected into it, a pump station that would again bring sewer to the same location. This would be more expensive. There's more pipe involved. Gravity pipes are more expensive to install than force main, but that would allow service for all the properties along the route. I'd be happy to answer any other questions. Steve is here. I don't know if you want to say a few words. But as far as the need, that would have to be determined in the study itself.
So my name is Stephen St. Germain. I bought the property in 2013. I grew up in Plainfield. I'm from the area. We're just trying to make the property stronger for the tenants and the residents that are there. Over the last 40 or 50 years, there probably have been minor bumps. We are not failing at the moment, but I know that the life of these systems, they're old, they're tired, and we want to keep all our residents in place and not have a failure which would go to the state level, which would probably take a very extended period of time to come up with a plan to fix or repair on site. I mean, city sewer, I think, is a viable option. When they built these a long time ago, I don't think they, like, Bob said, you know, there weren't baffles, there weren't filters on tanks, there weren't partitions, dry wells are made out of cinder blocks, you know, there's just no reserve area. You know, there's, if you look at the site map, most of it is existing system or parking lot as it stands now, and I don't think they really planned 50 years ago for what was to come and just dealt with it in that manner. We are actively pumping on a rotating basis all 36 systems, and that occurs about every 9 months. Mm-hmm. And just a little bit of maintenance is, I think, what's keeping the system alive at the moment. And we're going to continue it until something more viable comes along. And that's really what I have to say, unless you have questions for me.
Go ahead.
So you have 36 what? Septic tanks, 36 leach fields, 36?
So there's 18 buildings.
Right.
And each half of a building has its own 1,500-gallon tank with two connected dry wells. Hmm. So there's technically, for 18 buildings, 36 individual systems. So each half of a building has its own system.
They're all functional?
They're all currently functional.
So explain to me, so force feed means that you're actually going to push the waste, correct?
Yeah, force main would be a pump would be involved, and it'd be pushing through a small diameter pipe.
And the reason why you can't hook up to a force main, we'd have to be gravity if people wanted to hook up. What's the reason behind that, the engineering reason for that?
Most municipalities, unless you have a low-pressure gravity system, most municipalities don't want you connecting to a force main.
But why?
It just creates. Do you want to?
It forces it back into your home.
Yeah, you have to have check valve systems, and there's the potential for something more catastrophic to happen. if you're connecting to a large force main. There's a lot of low pressure systems. Some towns accept low pressure systems. I don't think Montville's one of them. East Hampton, Killingly, they have low pressure systems near lakes where there's a very small, maybe inch and a half, 2 inch diameter pipe. There's these ejector pumps in everyone's house, and one pumps and forces it down the line. But municipalities in this area, Norwich, for example, they just don't allow low pressure systems. You have one large force main, everything gravities to a pump station, and force main in this case would probably be a 4 inch in size to handle that flow.
So at the Peridissia now, is you're pumping every 9 months, you said?
Mm-hmm. Repeat that question.
The periodicity of your pumping is now 9 months cycle?
Yeah, we have Wind River come every 3 to 4 weeks, and they grab a certain amount of tanks. So if it's 36 tanks, they're grabbing on average 4 tanks every month. Mm-hmm. So
is that the way it's always been? I'm kind of curious, or has it increased the pumping?
No, it's so when we took over in 2013, we were told by the prior owner that he was forced to shut down all of the laundry rooms. There was originally a laundry room in every building, mm-hmm. and they were due to system issues prior to my ownership. They were required to close them all down and make a centralized laundry facility behind the office, or the N as in Nancy building. And then they put a newer system in there to supposedly handle all the capacity of 114 tenants doing a number of loads a week. Because the tanks were in the laundry rooms were all shut down, and we felt, and we had some minor issues when we first bought the property. I don't know when the prior owner had ever pumped them, but we started pumping them, and it was suggested to us by, at the time it was Parent Sanitation, but he has since sold to Wind River. He says, you know, your systems are really old and tired. It would be his professional opinion before they start failing to do a little bit of maintenance. You know, a couple of the tanks have outlet filters, maybe 4 out of 36. And that he's just said, why don't we just start pumping them? And it was a reasonable fee 13 years ago. I mean, obviously costs have increased drastically. We're not paying 10 cents a gallon anymore. We're paying 35 cents a gallon. And then there's fuel surcharges now because of the cost of diesel and everything else. But it's working at the moment. You know, can a dry well, you know, the cinder blocks collapse that are forming the dry wells? A couple of the dry wells we've opened in previous years for examination purposes look like they're 60-70% full of a crude oil type substance, which is residue, and that means that the dry wells, you know, in theory should be mostly dry, right? That's hence the name, and that they're probably getting close to the end of their life, and shy of doing I don't know what. I don't think they're fixable at this point.
Is there an industry standard for life expectancy for a dry well in this usage?
These type of systems, the industry standard is about 20 or 30 years before you replace
it. And we're at 60.
Yep.
Is there a location on site that you know to build new systems?
He's using every scrap right now where these systems are. See, the buildings are, these systems are in these grass areas in front. Are they in the parking lot too?
Some of them go underneath the parking lots. Most of the dry wells, I don't think, are under the parking lots because they probably would have collapsed by now.
Why can't we just put it on
but
the system?
There's no reserve area that was ever, when they built these, reserve was probably not a novel theory back in the 60s. So the first two started across the street at 90 Leffingwell in 1965. And then they slowly, between 65 and the mid-70s, went all the way down to as far as that large yellow box is. At that point, the road continues, but I believe they were probably stopped eventually by wetlands because they were heading towards the brook, and wetlands probably kicked in the late 70s and said, you know, you can't get any closer to the brook. So I don't know what...
Has it been studied, though? Have you studied the property to see if it could be replaced, if the system could be replaced? And if you have enough property to do so?
So there was one tank in the A building back in 2009 that the previous owner said he was forced to replace because it failed or collapsed or something. And he had to pump. It got pushed beyond Uncas Health because of the size of the project to the state level. and he was forced to pump the tank every 3 days for 6 months until the state could make a decision. So I don't know that, and there was, and they basically after 6 months said pull the tank out and put a new tank in the same exact spot because there's no excess land, there's no reserve, there's, if you go most of this drive through this property, there's no land left. You know, we have water mains, we have underground gas lines now, we have, there's just no capacity. They didn't plan. I mean, there's no reserve. I mean, that's just the nature of the way it was maybe 50 years ago. I don't know.
To build on that, I could use some clarification on whether the study would be to study the feasibility of connecting to sewer or to determine what your replacement or fixture options would be.
It would be both. The study would look at if there was an option for replacing that in place and the municipal connection option.
Will the study also include the financial impact to the town?
The study will determine cost.
So do you think that there will be a grant that covers this pipe, or is the town of Montville sewer users going to pay for that?
So the intent is that the pre-development grant, planning grant that we're talking about tonight is the first step that would then set the stage to apply for a second grant that would fund fully 100% of the construction of that forest main. So, my thoughts was, and I wanted to confirm this with the USDA to see if they if this could be allowed and would be funded through this planning grant, was one, to do the feasibility on site to understand the need, and then that's step one in my mind. If there's two outcomes. That study could then show, no, there is an opportunity to do this on site. Okay, then that comes back to the commission. For another 824, if they decide that they would rather go forward with a connection, I guess the question is it appropriate in the commission's eyes to support an 824 for something like that if that was even to be requested? If the need on site says it can't be accommodated on site, then the next step is to study the forest main and the impacts to the WPCF facility. There is a 25% match, as I had mentioned. Mr. St. Germain had indicated, I believe, and I don't put words in your mouth, that you would be covering that match requirement. It wouldn't be a cost to the town other than the administrative burden, that staff time of writing the grant. And administering the grant, and I think we'd be remiss if we didn't ask Ron if he had anything to add that he wanted to come up and mention on this matter too. So,
thank you, Dennis. Ron McDaniel, WPCA administrator. Listen, this is the first step in going towards whether or not it's actually feasible to do this. Mm-hmm. So. Is it in the public interest to do this? Absolutely. You want more people hooked up to the sewer system. Can the plant handle the capacity? It can. So we just have to see whether it's feasible to actually do this right now. There are going to be some improvements that are going to be needed on our end, mostly on the lift stations. So this is going to have two pump stations, one at the property, another lift station, then it has to go through the Holly Hill pump station, and then to Avery 1 before it gets to the plant. So there's going to be some improvements that are going to be needed on the WPCF side as well.
So,
go ahead, Sarah.
So if the town is going to apply for a grant to do a sewer-related study, I would want the scope to include the broader system-wide capacity and analysis of that so that we could understand whether this is, isolated or part of a broader infrastructure strategy, perhaps.
So there's not many customers that they're going to be able to pick up during in this process. This is why I think that Dennis brought this to the commission's attention, because of the industrial possible uses in that area. He's looking at whatever capacity could be developed in that area, but that would have the gravity side to the project.
Let me ask a quick question if I could. Have you thrown any hand grenades at what the cost would be to install a pump station on the site to accommodate the apartment complex and a force main to dump into the nearest gravity manhole? Has there been a number pulled out of the sky for that?
Yeah, we kicked around a number.
We have a number from Wright Pierce.
Yeah, I mean that number.
I think it was a gravity.
It included
the gravity and the force main and two pump stations, and it was $11 million.
Yeah, okay. The number we kicked around was quite a bit less than that.
I mean that seems high to me, but that's the preliminary number.
So if you were to just do a lift station for the 114 units, with a force main dedicated only to that project.
We were in this one.
It would still take two lift stations, and then it has to go through Holly Hill and Avery.
I think Bill's talking about one pump station and doing.
One pump station force main to the closest gravity manhole, and
which is at the corner of Fitch Hill.
And two lifts. Okay. Corner of Fitch Hill and Leffingwell.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you got to get out.
That's the nearest gravity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now. Historically, when the town builds sewer systems and infrastructure in town, the beneficiaries pay an assessment, pay a connection fee, etc. Are you, the apartment owner, prepared to enter into some repayment program for this benefit?
I believe that when we discussed, so when I was here 6 years ago, when you were the mayor, we talked about having a private line under a public road, and that wasn't allowed. And then the Pollution Control Authority then said, why don't we waive all the connection fees, and that wasn't statutorily allowed. We haven't discussed that, but on a $4 or $5 million project, if we just do the force main to the manhole, there was a component on USDA where they would do like a certain amount of match money, and then the rest of the money for the construction would be on me at like, you know, a low interest rate for a 40-year AM schedule. We didn't discuss connection fees, but I assume that they're statutorily required.
Unless
you want to let me out of them, that would be fine.
My decision.
I don't think you're going to be able to, because when we went around this 6 years ago, it was brought up by WPCA, the board, that it was not allowed to. I was paying them, so I would assume that would still be the case.
I think you were asking about the infrastructure costs. He agreed to.
Yeah,
I understand you want to try to get a grant to be able to fund this thing to get it going. The grant can't be issued to a private property owner; it has to be issued to the municipality. Mm,
correct.
Right? There's a match. You're going to pick up the match. But now this grant that could be funding something else in this town is funding your facility. Historically, when sewers were built in town from day one, any property that received that sewer benefit had an assessment to pay, whether they paid it over time, and then any new person that came along that never paid an original assessment paid, originally it was like a $6,500 connection fee per unit. I think that hence has been reduced if the developer paid for the infrastructure, still had to pay a connection fee, but I think they chopped it in half. And I'm just throwing this out there so that, you know, if this is financially fair to the town of Montville, we understand you got 114 units. We just went through an entire presentation hearing about House Bill 8002, and, you know, we have to create all this affordable housing, and, you know, we're very cognizant of that. we understand you have a problem. It's going to be a health problem. You know, we're not the final say in all this, but we're supposed to make a decision today whether or not we have a favorable opinion on allowing this to happen in the road. I'd like to get an understanding if, you know, you as the applicant, private owner, you know, unless we're partners and we're sharing in the rental income for the next 50 years, although I don't know if the town wants to be your partner, but I'm just throwing these things out there. What's going to be the equitable answer at the end of the day? Are we giving up the potential for a USDA grant for something else we could use?
Well, USDA has, they haven't loaned in the state in years, and they're dying to get back in. Is that, Dennis, what they were indicating, and that they're now loaning? And I don't know that they have specific restrictions or requirements, but they appear to have plenty of money and are dying to do projects. So I don't know, but I'm willing to also pay my fair share. I'm not here to, you know, I mean, if it's a 15 or, you know, they're going to match as a grant a portion of it, and then there's going to be a low interest loan on the other 80% for a duration of time that I'm going to have to pay. So I'm, you know, and if we have to bake a connection fee into this project, if that's allowable and doable, then we can do that as well.
Those are the words that I'm looking to hear.
I'm here because I think the cost of this is prudent versus the cost of the alternative. You know, if a building fails tomorrow, what do I do with six families? I mean, do we, you know, get them, send them? The other thing, and not to sidebar this, but I did have an issue. So when I first bought the property, we were talking about issues, and one did come to mind that I dealt with Uncas Health on when I first bought the property in August of 2013. Over by the L building towards the highway, there was this really, really big, beautiful garden, like the size of this room. And the garden was, you know, I went up and I started introducing myself and talking to a couple of the tenants, and there's this beautiful stream running down the middle of the garden. And I said, you know, I didn't know there was any water on the property. Where, you know, it's one of my water mains leaking or my well pipes. And the tenants lifted up a sheet of plywood, and there was these nice square cement blocks. So it was actually, they had dug into one of the dry wells, must have overflowed, and they created a stream, and they had a beautiful garden, but I did not eat anything out of the garden because we all know why, where the water was coming from. So there have been issues over time, be it minor and fixable. And there was an older gentleman with a white beard at Uncas Health at the time, and he came out and he said, you know, let them pick all their stuff, and then we have to bring in gravel and loam, and we have to rebury all this and seed it, and no more gardens. So we have, that's one minor issue that I can think of. I mean, is it going to happen again? Probably. But at the end of the day, you know, we just want to make it better. We're trying to put in charging stations for the tenants as well. I assume eventually somebody's going to have a hybrid plug-in or an electric car. I'd love to have some relief on my parking issues because I don't comply with parking, and it would be nice to have additional four spots to put in. Eversource is giving away money at the moment, and they're going to give me 40 or 50 grand to put in four charging stations, but I don't have any parking that's suitable, or I don't comply with the new parking regs, so they're kind of denying that. So that would be nice if, you know.
Well, we don't negotiate.
No, I hear you, but I'm just
deals here on the sewer or not. But to make a recommendation moving forward,
yes,
you know, you're making a statement that you're willing to participate.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that when this was built in the '60s, there was no rules. So 9x16 parking spots aren't conforming now, so I can't put in charging stations. Septics didn't have reserves. They didn't build them to code and to standards, so there's no really repair or replacement that's viable. You know, there's a lot of things, but we're trying to keep the property active, and we've been doing a lot of maintenance and repairs and want to keep all the families in there and, you know, maybe someday expand the property if, you know, the gravel bank to the left ever sells out and we're hooked up to sewer. You never know.
One last question. Are any of your rents meet the affordable rates in the state of Connecticut? They may not be deed restricted as such, but just out of curiosity, are any of your rental units within that?
Most of my rents fall into they don't fall. I mean, affordable housing in HUD is, you know, like 80% of most of the people, if you look at the average rents, you know, 80% of my tenants fall in those ranges. Are they on HUD? No. Do they get subsidies? No. But they're all technically.
I think where the chairman is going is maybe part of the process here is to talk about some deed restrictions on your rent. If they're naturally in that range of being affordable anyways, you know, then maybe there's a deed restriction so we can also get the benefit of meeting our...
The town would get the benefit of upping our percentage of affordable units out there, and that may offset our ability to say, okay, take some of that USDA money. And, you know, I'm trying to create a fair win-win. I'm not a believer that we have to bail out every problem that everybody has.
No, I understand where you're going with that.
I'm also... If we can find some equity in the whole situation, maybe we can make a favorable recommendation and let the semantics get worked out at a higher level here.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, deed restriction is a difficult, is a lot of towns, like, they did it in stores. They built a big 400 unit up past Yukon, and they had to deed restrict 35 units, and they can't rent them. Because 80% of $3,500 a month is $2,800, and nobody, that's your blue-collar worker or family, can afford that $2,800. They'd be better served to buy a house and get a mortgage at that kind of money. So they're kind of stuck with the town board. I don't know if you've read about that situation, but we would consider it, you know. I mean,
yeah, I think stores is a completely different demographic than we're talking about here.
No, I understand that.
No, and we get it. I think the point is if there's an opportunity to talk about that.
Now, you said organically, though, you can't back into affordability. How would you qualify these as low or affordable?
You'd write it into the land records, into the deed, that a certain number of units would be set aside deed restriction for people earning a certain percentage of the area median income. 80% would be the maximum amount, which 80%.
The mortgage company would have to agree with it.
So, I mean, we have a CMBS mortgage on the property now, which is with a company out of, I don't even know where, New York or somewhere, and they have a lot of restrictions. We can't, you know, like on financing and stuff, so they would have to agree as well.
Yeah, and I think that what the chairman is suggesting, and I was actually thinking the same thing, is just, is there an opportunity to talk about it?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah. We're amicable to listen. I mean, all's fair.
I mean,
that's where all the decisions are.
It's part of the tools out there with all this, you know, grant money, et cetera. And,
okay. One more comment?
Yep, go ahead.
Thank you. Again, I just think it is just for your consideration as you're considering this for the public benefit. It is a benefit to the public in general to have more people hooked up to sanitary sewer and public water, A. B, they're right by a Class A water body, the Trading Cove Brook, that runs right by that property. Mm-hmm. So if there is some sort of failure, not only may it affect their groundwater, which affects their wells over there, it may affect that water body as well. So that is a concern that I think the USDA shares as well. Also, we were unable to look at these USDA loans in the past because we're a population over 10,000, and we didn't qualify under rural water standards. They're willing to look at us under certain census tracts right now, and it's an opportunity that we have to try to grab. Now, I'm not pro or anti this project whatsoever, but I don't think it hurts to, you know, just go for the grant right now, the planning grant, and see where it falls out.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we need to understand that and understand what your capacity is for other reasons. So, you know, that we would definitely support, I think, the grant for sure. The big picture, the project, I think there needs to be a commitment from the developer to participate, but that should be worked out at a higher level.
Okay.
All right, Wills, you got questions?
I do, more towards you, Dennis. I'm a little confused here. So the USDA is saying they can't support a private landowner or whatever, but they can support us to give them the opportunity to do this project, in summary. Is that what you're saying?
Yep. It can't be the applicant.
They can't be the applicant.
They can't be the applicant,
correct. So here's my problem with this project. we don't have a precedence anywhere in town, do we? That we've done
like
this before?
Where not we've that done... I'm aware of. Ron might know better than I do, or the mayor. But
okay. I'm thinking to myself, we probably have multiple areas like Mr. Germain's that have issues. Am I correct?
Not that we know of yet.
Fair assumption.
I'm just thinking, we have a lot of mobile parks.
Oh, yeah.
I'm thinking of Williams Road. I'm thinking of areas in town where we're old. I mean, there's quite a few areas. So I'm not adverse to the idea, but I am curious about a little more information so we can understand the possible number of projects this could affect in Montville, except for Leffingwell. If we start, I'd like to know a little more information in a timely fashion, not to. But I think it's important we understand, are there other areas that could be the same thing as we're talking about here?
So you have 35 days to make a decision, and no action is indication of an approval. So if you're not willing to make a decision or you need more information to make an informed decision, and you know, staff can come back at the next meeting and answer questions such as that or any others that you might have, and a decision can be made at the next meeting.
I just think it's prudent for us as a commission and, you know, to be prepared for the whole community in general. I think, you know, the chairman's made a good point about this whole project, you know, and I think I need a little more information to understand.
One of my biggest concerns was setting a precedent. And
right, the precedent
general,
bothers,
you know,
me.
And just to be candid, you know, with the large development on Massapequa Side Road and sewer, you know, water extensions and sewer extensions as well. This is different, though. I mean, we've got 100-something residents, you know, so that we have to think about. So, you know, there I don't think a precedent in that terms would be set. But in other locations, and we are in a sanitary sewer service area, so we're not. It's not like we're in an area that would require, you know, going back to OPM or anything like that. So it, you know, policy wise, it can be done. It's just a matter of the town setting the precedent.
This 824 review is for the planning.
The planning grant only.
Planning grant only. Yep.
Yeah.
Not
so,
for construction.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, because the planning grant.
Are we comfortable with at least
planning?
Yeah.
Moving forward with the planning grant,
I think
with notations that we want that planning looking at
is a feasible
a bigger picture of capacity,
yep,
and other potential.
Yeah.
Near catastrophes.
Yeah, the motion in this report was drafted specific to just that one grant and not jumping the gun, so that way everybody had an opportunity to understand the results of that planning preliminary engineering report that would be done.
But we're not approving pipe down
that.
The road. We're
no.
not approving building the
yeah.
project. How do you feel about
that? But you're thinking the scope would be the whole town versus just one particular piece.
Well, I think.
Well,
you know,
that's my issue. I think if we get a grant and we use it on one private property.
Right.
So I identified four scope items that I ran by the USDA to see if they can be included.
Okay.
Now the question is, can all four be done for the $87,000 that we're talking about, right? So one is the on-site feasibility of this system.
Mm-hmm.
And if that is determined not be feasible with an on-site solution, then prepare the initial plans for the force main that we're talking about to have a better understanding of how that would work. Three is, what are the implications on the water pollution control facility to make sure that we understand that. And then look at it more holistically from a growth potential, because you can't just say, okay, so I think there's a lot of other issues and matters going on with our agreements that are in place with other organizations as well. and what's left over for the town and starting to think about growth for the town itself. And that'll be looked at in more detail when we do our POCD and our housing growth plan. We have to look at that. But I think we would be remiss at having some level of an opportunity to look at the big picture of utilities, specifically in this case, sanitary service servicing the town as a whole. I don't sure what that is, but I think that's the benefit of the town supporting this, is that's what we would get, how small that might be or how big that element would be in that $87,000 ask. I don't know. You know, it might be $10,000 of the 87 because you need 77,000 to do the necessary testing on site and to do the necessary evaluations. You know, I don't know, and CLA can certainly speak to that better than I can, you know.
What do you think, Bob? How much could you do that study for?
I didn't. Oh, okay.
I didn't put you on the spot. He did.
Yeah, I think we kicked around. I mean, a PER, which we've done before, is usually around $30,000 or something like that. You were talking about an expanded study, looking at zoning, build-out, and things of that nature, correct?
Yeah, that's correct, and I think we would need to also look at who that appropriate consultant would be to work with the town on our end, where you'd be working with the landowner. But, so that would be something we'd have to all talk about. We'll scope it all out. So.
But it sounded like the limit was 65,000.
Well, with the match, it would be 87,000.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a pretty sizable amount to do the study.
So I get the humanity side of it. I have no issue with that. I'm concerned about the precedents, and I'm concerned about going for one private landowner. I think that's what Commissioner Lundy's saying, and I think I'm not going to speak for anybody else, but if we can get it so we can look at the other areas that potentially would fall into the same situation Mr. Germain's in, I think that's more palatable to the public to say we're going to pull a grant for these private entities. You know, at the end of the day, the humanity side outweighs everything, but I mean, there has to be some basis for equity here, for lack of better words. That's all. Just,
well, you know, in the motion I've included, not to jump the gun, but under the approval motion, I said this motion includes the recommendation that the grant application also evaluates the water pollution control facilities capacity expansion potential to, one, ensure no negative impacts to future capacities created by this possible connection, and two, understand overall facility capacity to support future town development. So, and then this study must include necessary on-site investigations such as soil testing, calculations, and surveys to ensure no on-site solutions are possible. And then I also go on to say that the Commission's decision is not a precedent to indicate support for taking a similar approach to mitigating other private development, existing or proposed, for the benefit of said private development. So.
So I understand your motion. I know, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to make sure I understand
fire
this.
Fire away.
I want to make sure, in my mind, that I'm all for the grant, but I want to make sure it covers as much as possible for $87,000, except for one entity, Mr. Germain's. I think it's absolutely critical to the people of Montville to know that we're not just picking one private organization and doing 824 and say we're going to get money for you and help you out. The reason is excellent. It's the logistics I have a problem with. That's all. Yep. I want to make sure that if there's other people that need this, let's take a look at this and understand the scope of it, because I haven't been here all my life, but I'm sure there's other areas that are experiencing the same thing Mr. Germain's experiencing right now.
Nobody else has come to you, Mayor, right?
How about Plato's Drive?
I don't know.
For the record, Mayor Bunnell, you keep saying you want to be clear on this. Well, it's been perfectly clear that this is not just to benefit a landlord. This is to benefit the town, It benefits all the residents in the town that live in those units. It benefits the town to plan for what else is in the area. This isn't just about one thing. This is about everything that's been brought to you tonight. There is a benefit to the town. When it benefits the residents, it benefits the towns, the town. And all of the property that this system will run by is going to benefit them too. So I think it's a win situation, and it's only the plan. You want to debate later on about the 11 million or whatever the millions of dollars is going to be, that's not going to be at a cost of the town either. But we shouldn't even be debating that. We should be debating, do we want to make this plan, apply for the grant that is going to be paid for partially by the property owner? I think it's a win situation.
So I agree with the mayor on that. I'm just trying to add in if there's any other possibilities that we could put into this other areas of town, that'd be nice if we could do it.
I think that if I'm hearing you correctly, is, you know, part of this is to look at what other areas that might
benefit from this grant.
Well, that is what I was suggesting in my fourth scope item. Is it is very vague, but you know, what's the growth potential of the WPCF to benefit the growth of the town? I think that was one of the items too in the motion that. You know, to understand the overall capacity to support future town development. So that could be in any part of town.
It's one of the most important things we need to know as a planning commission moving forward is
how far that
understanding the capacity of our treatment plant, not just for Mr. St. Germain, but for every other project that walks in this door. Yeah. So, you know, the grant will be providing us with that information.
And that work will complement and take some pressure off of the monies that we have for the set aside that had been approved for the POCD, as well as the grant we got for the housing from Department of Housing as well. So they miraculously, these are all like coming together at the same time, right? You know, so they can all be looked at holistically, you know, over the course of the next 12 months.
And we'll say, since I've been here, the Meadows are the only ones that I know of that have been coming in to talk about this. I don't know any other.
I would have been fine with that answer 15 minutes ago. No, I just want to make sure. I have no issue with the mayor's comments or anybody's comments. I just want to make sure that we understand if there's any other areas. And you've said now clearly there nobody has come to our attention.
In the sake of moving on, are you ready to act on this, Josh?
Might as well.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to make a motion?
I make a motion to forward a report of approval to the town council in accordance with Connecticut General Statute 8-24 for the submission of the U.S. Department of Agriculture Water and Waste Disposal Pre-development planning grant associated with the request by Mayor Leonard Bunnell and Finance Director Julie Chapman. The Commission finds that studying the feasibility of connecting the site's sanitary services to the existing town system to mitigate the on-site sanitary issues as being consistent with the 2022 Plan of Conservation and Development by protecting watersheds and ensuring housing options. This motion includes the recommendation that the grant application also evaluates the WPCF facilities capacity expansion potential to one. Ensure no negative impacts to future capacities created by this possible connection, and two, to understand overall WPCF capacity to support future town development. The study must include necessary on-site investigations, such as soil testing, calculations, and surveys to ensure no on-site solutions are possible. The town council should take note that this decision is specific to the unique circumstance of this particular site due to its failing on-site system, and the commission's decision is not a precedent to indicate support for taking a similar approach to mitigating other private development, existing or proposed, for the benefit of said private development.
I'll second that motion.
We have a motion and a second.
Any discussion? Roll call vote.
Okay. Commissioner Terry.
Favor.
Yes. Mr. Gillette's not here. Commissioner Pike.
Favor.
Yes. Commissioner Desjardins, in favor. Commissioner Lundy.
In favor.
Commissioner Kobelik.
In favor.
And he's not here. And Chairman
in favor.
Okay, everybody's in favor.
Thank you.
Is that here?
Okay. New business, AB. Whoa, 10 after 8. Does anyone need a break?
Anybody's,
can we take a 5-minute recess?
Sure.
No problem with that?
Nope.
No, go ahead.
Take a 5-minute recess.
Okay, stretch your leg. Take a whiz.
You all right?
Don't want me to. I need to stretch my legs.
Oh, boy. Okay, what's this one right here? Okay, what's the next night's agenda? Let's look at the old dry wells. I probably built one my time when I was a little kid.
Boy. I didn't hit stop. I hit.
Josh, remember the old dry wells? I built one with my father when I was about 3 or 4 years old. We had all them.
Hold on. Ready?
Ready.
Okay,
it's 8:15. We're back from our recess. We're going to move on to, under our new business, agenda item 8B, which is an 824 review for the redevelopment and future sale of a portion of 911 Route 32. And Dennis, it's you again.
This 824 referral is just as it says. It's for the redevelopment and future sale of a portion of 911 Route 32. In the report, you'll see a map of the property. There's an area circled in a white dash called development area. The town is interested in offering a portion of this property for sale to a development entity, whomever that might be, to provide the preference is to provide an opportunity for elderly housing. We have an RFP out, which is due on July 15th. We've had some interest. We have one national developer who we are going to be talking with as well. I'll just leave it at that for now. And then we have been also, as part of this, we are talking with the owners of the former Houghton Manor site. We would need to have access through their property to the area of 911 Route 32 provide access for parking for the residents for people that live there. We cannot come in from the PD side. The impoundment lot is over there, and just from a security standpoint as well. So this is an RFP that has been actually issued as a joint venture approach with the with the owners of Houghton Manor. They would like to see their property redeveloped as well. We have a loose joint venture agreement in place with them currently that they've signed and that the mayor has signed as well. It would also require access over the back portion of the general Dollar General site as well. So and we were talking with ownership there on the likelihood of that. So this is for the sale, the redevelopment, possible subdivision of this parcel. And it's being proactive for when we identify a prospective purchaser and developer.
That's probably right behind, you call it the safety station? I mean, the safety building, the police station? Yeah, all that probably behind that.
Yeah, it's right behind it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How many acres is it?
It Geez, did I not put that on here?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. Off the top of my head, it's going to probably be about, what, 15, 20 acres? Or, do I have it somewhere down? Mm-hmm. I guess I was way off.
All right, any commission members? Any other questions for Dennis? Lisa?
841 Route 32, the town and owner of 841 Route 32 reserves the right to reject. Do we know?
I'm sorry.
841 Route 32 has the right to reject any and all proposals.
That's in the proposal, in the RFP, yeah. That's right. That's just standard language in an RFP.
Standard language.
Yeah.
I don't have any questions. It's fine.
In the RFP, was that's already been issued. That was just for context for you all.
Oh, okay.
We need a little help back there.
So we have somebody who wants to build something back here.
Sarah, questions?
What zoning amendments are you anticipating needing to do after this?
There might be some bulk standards. Not sure yet. I didn't really dive into it that deeply, to be honest with you. There is a site plan in there. I don't think there's going to be too many, but there might be some bulk standards. It's going to come down to what the developer wants to do, too. You know, should we be fortunate enough to get a developer, what their product is. So I didn't do a full zoning analysis. I to plant a seed of interest, I developed that site plan that you see in there with the 250 plus or minus units between the two sites. So I don't know.
Through the river.
For sure.
Yeah, it's kind of nice, right?
Mm-hmm. And then so. Beyond the access issues you've already identified and are working on, are there any other known constraints that could affect whether the property could be redeveloped?
We're near where the impoundment lot is. There's a cemetery. There's a couple of individuals as well as a horse that's buried. That has been identified and located on CLA's survey. The concept plan that you see in the RFP does respect that. Archaeology, we have talked, the mayor's talked with the tribe. They do have it on their list of places to explore, to identify, to see if there's any archaeological resources on that property. Wetlands have been delineated, I shouldn't say delineated. The site has been walked by CLA, by Bob Russo. He sketched out wetland limits, which are also represented on that plan. I would, when I developed that concept, I respected those boundaries and don't foresee direct impacts to wetlands. Maybe there's a couple. Actually, I take that back. I think there might be one area. There's a fill slope. The trail that is there. There might be an impact to the trail depending on how the development happens. But it's not so substantial that it couldn't very easily be relocated. It's a very minor corner. But it all. You know, the developable area is on top of that slope. You know, once you start encroaching a little bit down that slope, you can't get much further. If you're chasing grade, then you get into the wetlands, into the lower flood areas. So.
There's 841, that's all, okay.
Josh, any thoughts, questions?
Does 911 look to
the Yeah, I see that, yeah, okay. Not really. I mean, they're looking for a developer. I mean,
ties into a near location to our revive and renew of Route 32. Overlook some water.
Yeah, this was one of the nodes. Property. This was one of the nodes that they identified. They didn't get study it in depth like they did in the town center or up the street a little bit more, you know. But if we could get somebody like I'm thinking we might be able to get and entice, and you know, it could be a catalyst for that area and something better, not just for this, but maybe even the properties that are directly adjacent to it, you know, some tired properties there. And it could definitely be a benefit.
Our utilities are there.
Our utilities are there.
We have water, we have gas.
Yeah, and the plan, you know, it's subject to, you know, approval from, you know, the adjacent landowner and their tenant, but consolidating curb cuts, too, with Dollar General, and it could benefit them. They might get a little additional parking. It would be safer coming in and out. Add some more walking trails and public access down along the waterfront, which is lovely back there if you haven't walked that trail. So
this would add to the list of multiple projects we want to build, and we still need to have our capacity of sewer, correct? I think it's a good idea of use of land. I think it's,
yeah.
I like this idea.
John?
Yeah.
You good?
Lise?
Mm-hmm. Who has the draft motion?
I have it right here.
You do?
I make a motion to forward a report of approval to the town council in accordance with Connecticut General Statute 824 for the future sale of a portion of 911 Route 32 associated with the request by Mayor Leonard Bunnell and Finance Director Julie Chapman. The commission finds that offering the land for housing options is consistent with the 2022 Plan of Conservation and Development. This includes the preservation of the existing recreation trail upon the site and, if necessary, modification to said trail. Furthermore, consideration shall be given to understanding archaeological resources and, if present, taking the necessary steps to conserve resources that may exist.
Okay, we have a motion.
I'll second it.
And a second. Any discussion on the motion?
Oh, yeah, I got one thing about it. This is concerning, you call it, says, you call it, Tallahassee connected Mohegan tribe regarding archaeological. You know, we have a state archaeologist. They've been notified too because that's where they get paid.
Yeah, the Mohegans had done the archaeological study
for
the public safety building as well. Yeah. The mayor reached out to them and they're more than willing to do it.
Okay, thank you for that information. Appreciate that. Any other discussion on the motion? Roll call vote.
Okay. Commissioner Longton, not here. Commissioner Terry?
Favor.
Commissioner Gillette, not here. Commissioner Pike?
Favor.
Commissioner Durant, I'm in favor. Commissioner Lundy?
In favor.
Commissioner Kobluck?
In favor.
Commissioner Summers, not here. Commissioner Pinas?
Favor.
Okay, everybody's in favor.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, moving on. Again, under new business, 8C. 26, Site 6, 2020, Route 32, 099-045-00A, a recycling station to be installed within the existing parking lot limits. The applicant is Count and Crush LLC, DBA, Slink, owner, Montville Station LLC. This is for receipt only from the commission, acknowledging we've received this application.
Yes.
It's still under review, correct?
Correct.
So, briefly, this is at the Montville Common Stop and Shop delivery area, and staff's going to continue to review it, so we're going to make a motion to continue this to, did we
July
pick a meeting?
July
28th. So, entertain a motion for the continuance to July 28th.
So moved.
Okay. You'll second that,
I'll
right,
second
John?
That, right, yeah.
Thank you very much. Sorry. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone oppose? Anyone abstain? Okay. We're going to continue that to the 28th of July. 8D, 26, Site 7.
Yeah, I do too.
18 Powerhouse Road. 070-034-000. Modifications of a previously approved PZC application. 25 Site 2. The applicant, Fetis Engineering. The owner, J&E Holdings LLC. Dennis will explain.
Okay.
Put you on the spot. Sorry.
There's a problem right here. Okay.
What am I
Feathers Dream LLC.
Did you want to do
it about the garages all the way
versus before them?
That's what you told me you were going to do as an administrative approval.
I think we decided that would be.
I have no idea.
This one would come back.
Yeah, Park House Road.
I think we decided we were going to come back.
I think it should. Okay. Sorry. We're having our own little discussion.
Yeah, no.
No problemo.
So I'll give you a brief what I know. I looked at this quickly today. This was before you previously known as 145/32/18 Powerhouse Lane, Powerhouse Road. John Iwano was the applicant. He got an approval. He merged the properties together, and he got his zoning permit for the first phase. When he got out there, he started to build some things not according to the plan. Stacy noticed. I went out there with her, and she issued him a stop work until he brought in this modified plan. So he's now modifying the infiltration system, some of the temporary sediment control basins, locations of the stockpile, a reduction in some parking. He wants to turn some of the garages into living spaces / bedrooms. They were all going to be on slabs. Now he wants to make a basement at least in one of the buildings.
In multiple.
And then the building official pointed out today by looking at the plans, which I have not taken a deep dive into, that he potentially wants to put a garage under an existing structure that's already there. So this is going to require some time on our part.
So
it's not ready.
We need to continue this to at least July 28th.
Yes.
Okay. Motion to continue this item 8D to July 28th.
I'll make the motion.
You got the motion.
I'll second it.
You're number two again. Any discussion on this?
It sounds like somebody wants to be slick.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone oppose? Anyone abstain? This is continued to July 28th. We're at number nine, zoning matters.
Number nine.
Yes, it does. And to greet us with that is CEO Stacy Bradford.
So in your packet you have last month's report, I hope she can see. And this month's report. I'm just going to go over the stats from this month, but you do have both of them, so feel free to, if you come up with any questions on either one, give me a call at any point in time. So this would be for the zoning and wetlands report from May 26, 2026 to June 22, 2026. Total number of inquiries in the office were 194. Total zoning permits open at the beginning of the reporting period were 372. Total number of certificates of zoning compliance with field inspections permits which were closed were 16. There were a total number of 9 permits closed not needing the issuance of a certificate of zoning compliance. There were a total number of 21 field inspections. 46 new zoning permits have been issued, leaving us a total of current zoning permits open of 393. There's one new zoning complaint or enforcement action involving chickens. A total number of 12 ongoing enforcement actions. No enforcement actions were closed. There were no new wetland complaints. There are a total number of 2 ongoing in wetland enforcement actions. 1 wetland enforcement action was closed. And for inland wetlands, they had 3 applications. 2 of them were continued. 1 has been approved. And there are no new ZBA applications at this time. So again, if you have any questions either on this report or the other one, feel free to either ask now or contact me.
And ZBA
cease and desist.
Thank you. Nice job on the package, too, by the way.
Well, yeah, I love that.
Yes, I love the tabs.
Yeah, tabs. That way I don't search around for crap.
That is so great for me, anyway. I'm always like, oh.
No, it's a good idea. Very good
thank
idea.
Thank you. We were just talking about that.
It was due to her patience to do it.
Thank you, though. That's really helpful.
It's
very helpful.
Okay. You again, Dennis.
There's no reports tonight. It's already reported.
I'll leave it. What's left to report?
Come on now.
So first and foremost, announcement that Stacy Radford has passed her Casio 100%.
Very nice.
You got noticed two or three weeks ago on that event?
Congratulations.
Awesome. Good job, Stacy.
Fabulous.
Just a note as well about there was an email sent out about a special meeting. If you're available on the 8th of July, scratch that. That was just in case the hearing got continued. So no hearing on the 8th.
Oh.
Okay.
No meeting on the 8th.
Meeting on the 8th, okay.
Like right now, I'll forget.
So I just wanted to see if there's any feedback, first item feedback from the council presentation on Revive and Renew, if there's anything that you wanted to bring up, any thoughts. They're wrapping up the report. I have three more chapters to review tomorrow and Thursday to get to them. They're going to have a final draft report on the 1st. It'll be all formatted, prettied up, all the graphics and stuff with the text. So. But then it'll be done shortly after. But any feedback that you want to share?
I think it was a well-done project. It looks nice. A lot of good thought to it. I think it's something we should include in our POCD and strive to move in that direction.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely, yes.
I regret that I wasn't able to attend, but what was the general sentiment from town council?
I wasn't able to attend that night either.
Republic.
I think the town council was...
They were very attentive.
Yeah.
Yes.
And, I think everybody liked what was shown.
Okay.
It was a very interesting night because there were more people there concerned with ATVs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And on the redevelopment of the town of Montville, but
I think it could have been at a special, but they said because of the time constraints they had to hold it. But like I talked to one of the counselors, he was very excited and he thought it was great. He says if I ever see it in my lifetime, but you know, maybe. I think so. I'm positive.
I mean, if Dennis keeps writing grants or applying for grants.
I know.
Well, listen, it's takes a lot of people and a lot of help. But
I think this is the most forward movement we've had in a long time.
Well, and again, thanks for attending this evening for what we had to get done tonight. And it is important that your attendance here, it counts. Thank you all for showing up. And I think we've got to keep marching.
Absolutely.
So related to that, once the POCD is finalized, I wanted to recommend to the commission for considering adopting the Revive and Renew study either in whole or in part as part of the POCD. I'd like to put that on the agenda for the meeting in July. That is one of the final steps for our grant and to close out the grant. So. We'll need to have probably some action or motion to move forward with that, and then if you so are so inclined to start that process moving forward, we can wait and do it with the rest of the brand new POCD, but I think we want to capitalize on it now, get it in the POCD, because the grants that we want to apply for moving forward as they come available, we have it then solidified as policy, and we can, we always have to revert everything back to the POCD, as you know. So I'll bring that to you all for the July meeting. comprehensive plan update schedule. We have the advisory committee fully staffed out now. Staffed out, however you want to describe it. But the first meeting, and I think the meeting schedule was sent out by the mayor's assistant, Cindy. The first meeting will be with the advisory committee will be in September. I think it's September 8th. The bell. We have a kickoff meeting with the consultant team just at the staff level on July 8th. I might be confusing the dates there, but on July 8th to get that moving forward. And we also, the mayor signed the paperwork for closing on the housing grant, $125,000. We're just waiting for the commissioner to countersign. We should be getting that end of this week, I'm told. We should, by the end of July, get the full $125,000 deposited into our accounts, because that's not a reimbursement. We get the money, we have it ready to go. So, great. Which is nice. In your packet, I prepared a memo called Explanation of the Commission's Responsibilities During Review of Site Plan Applications, Imposing Modifications versus Conditions. This came up because of discussions staff had, that we had with our attorney, that I've had with the chairman, and it's always been, to some degree, an area of confusion for me. And I think modifications, the terms modifications and conditions are somewhat loosely used. I wanted to provide some clarification. For context, it has to do with the regulation changes that we have, some possible applications coming down the road, as well, but I don't know, has anybody had a chance to read this?
No.
I'll summarize some of the key points, but so there's three, so as you know, there's three types of applications. There's the zoning permit that Stacy, as this CEO, signs off on and does administratively. There's the site plans that are done for uses that are as of right, and you identify them in each zoning district, and then you have the special permits. So we have a lot more site plan applications and permitted uses rather than we do special permits. Site plans and associated with permitted uses, when you're saying something is a permitted use in a zoning district, the way I described it here is you're basically saying that use gets along in the district. It's appropriate to be there. You meet our guidelines, you meet what we say in our regulations, you can do it. Have fun, right? You have the number of parking spaces, you meet the setbacks, you meet building coverage if you have building coverage. Now that we have more robust landscaping requirements, you meet the landscaping requirements, boom, you're approved. It's administrative. It's really just a rubber stamp in some respects. The contrast is the special permit, where you act in your legislative capacity. You have a lot of discretion on making the decision. Something just doesn't feel right, doesn't pass the scratch and sniff test, denied, you're done. There's very little grounds for that to get overturned. You generally have special permit criteria, and you link your decision to the special permit criteria. Then that's where you can start to impose conditions, and conditions can be very broad and would be based generally on the special permit criteria, which we do have in our Section 16. On the contrary, the site plan applications, when you approve a site plan application, you have three options. You can approve, boom, you're done. You can approve with modifications, and then you deny. So modifications, when you say you're approving with modifications, you have to link those modifications to what's required in the zoning. So my example in here was of a refuse area, right? So if your regulations say that refuse areas are not allowed in a front yard, somebody puts it in there, and that's basically the only change, and you want to move things along, you say, okay, approved with modification that they relocate the refuse area outside of the front yard. So then they make that modification, they submit it to the ZEO, and they say, yep, the ZEO says, yep, it was that change was made, boom, zoning permit issued. Then they can go get their building permit. That's very simplified, mm-hmm. but that's the basic process. But if you don't have anything in there that says where refuse containers can go or can't go, they can put them anywhere on the site. You can't say you don't want it in the front yard. It might be the ugliest and most inappropriate spot because it's right up against their property line, which we have some around, right? Mm-hmm. But you just because you don't like it there, it doesn't say it in the zoning regulations, then you have to approve it, okay? You can't then just say, well, we condition it if you move it along. That's one type of an example.
You're talking about dumpsters, right?
Well, just in this one example. It could be anything else.
Yeah, I mean, how about somebody's garbage can?
Yeah, we're not regulating an exact garbage can, but in some respects we might be. But that's just one example. It might also be they put an accessory structure within in a setback on accident. You can modify that goes outside of the setback. But you can't just say, well, we're going to approve and we're going to condition this and we want more landscape screening because you have a residence nearby. Well, if they meet the landscape requirements, or before you had none, right? So you had to approve it. So now if they meet the landscape requirements, you can't require it under a site plan. But if they are a special permit and you believe they need to have more screening, then you can condition it. Or if you want them to move a use around on a site, if your regulations don't say that use has to be in a specific location, set away from wetlands or from the street line so many feet, they can put that use anywhere on the site. So you can't just arbitrarily under a site plan condition where that goes. So that's what they call the legal terminology is ministerial. So you have the definition out of Black's Law Dictionary is pretty clear in that it's point of law and so clear in matter of fact that no element of discretion is left to the precise mode of its performance. So there's absolutely no discretion in that decision. So I just want to make sure that you're aware that you don't have that ability to kind of arbitrarily make a decision on a site plan approval. And that's why it's important that we have standards, either use-specific standards that for site plan approval, or we carefully consider, case in point, our concerns about earth processing and concrete manufacturing, that you consider what uses really should be special permit versus what can we do as the ministerial review site plan and then have criteria that might be linked to unique type uses. And that's when Goma, New York starts getting into rezoning. We're going to have some workshops and talking about that. But moving forward, I wanted to make sure that you had an understanding of your role on those topics.
So you got control in your package on that.
Okay.
PIF update. I met last night at the TARP meeting. We're moving that forward to the town council at their meeting on the 13th of July. Hopefully that'll then be referred to you all. And a hearing will be set probably in the fall time by council with the intent to adopt the TIF districts by the end of this calendar year.
What does TIF stand for?
Oh, you were here for these discussions. TIF is Tax Increment Financing Districts. I can send you the packet.
Is that like a...
What's that?
Tax benefit for developing.
Yeah, well, you establish a district, and as the taxes increase inside that district, you capture the increment and then you put that money back into just that district for that district's benefit.
Okay, thank you.
It could be.
We submitted for the SIF round 9 back on June 5th, and that scope of work was for the implementation of Revive and Renew. So it includes some streetscape improvements out front of Town Hall, reorganizing the Town Hall entrance. I think you might have saw a graphic, and that same graphic that was at the presentation to Town Council. And it also includes renovations to Town Hall for HVAC and other infrastructure improvements. And there is another grant. This is a fantastic opportunity for the town. DECD has a pilot program for what's called their Grayfield Opportunity Grant. We are going to be submitting to conduct a existing conditions evaluation for 350 Route 32, which is the Dots Cafe property. Mm-hmm. The intent is to look at it holistically from hazardous building material, building condition for possible reuse or appropriateness for demo, look at the intersection and how the intersection may or may not impact the property. The intent is to understand the full disposition of that property, its value, so an appraisal will be done. With the possibility, of positioning the town for purchase of that property or acquisition in some manner in the future. The landowner is aware, and we have an access agreement sent over to them. They told me that they're going to sign it, so we will have the right to enter the property, conduct surveys and testing as well. So the total ask will probably be in the order of magnitude of $200,000 to $250,000. So I'm asking for a motion of support for that grant tonight to go along with that application, which is due on August 5th.
Okay, do we have a motion written here?
No, I didn't write one. I
kind of just said,
I think you should probably,
as it is on
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, okay.
So I make a motion to support the submission for the DECD Grayfield Opportunity Grant regarding 350 Route 32 conditions evaluation study, which is due August 5th, 2026, as it is consistent with the POCD.
I'll second that.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All
right.
Anyone oppose? Anyone abstain?
Go for it.
Get some more free money.
Right, and then the Nature Conservancy reached out to me about doing what they call a community building workshop, which is about understanding resiliency in the community and responding to storm events or changing of the climate. That'll be done as part of our POCD outreach process. It's going to be limited to probably two dozen individuals. It's going to be virtual. I got to work with the mayor to come up with a list of those attendees, free of charge, but it's going to be a great way to start kicking off understanding what some of the issues and opportunities are in the town from a resiliency and climate change standpoint and infrastructure standpoint, too. So we'll touch on things like the water pollution control facility, roadways, bridges, flooding, et cetera. So,
okay.
That was just an FYI. That will probably occur. We're looking at mid-September.
Okay, thank you, Dennis. Agenda item 11, fee schedule review, addition of site plan modification.
So we had talked before about all of the increases in the fees. Dennis did go to TARP last night, and then after we discussed it, we started getting modifications of approved site plans coming in. So I had suggested to Dennis that we include on the TARP fees a minor modification of an approved plan that could be done by administrative approval to start charging the applicants $150 plus the $60 state fee. If they come in for a regular application, that will be $300. So this would be
half of that fee. But if it is something that would need to come before this commission and it couldn't be done as a minor administrative approval, then they would pay the full $300 application fee if they were doing a major modification. So we included that, or Dennis included that last night, but we just wanted to run it by you and make sure you were okay with that before he brings it to town council.
Looks good to me. Any thoughts from anyone? Comments, questions?
Reasonable.
So you're changing a fee?
We're adding another fee.
Okay.
Because typically they'll come in and, you know, Stacy will be out on site. She'll realize they started doing something a little different. They'll draw up a new plan. We send it off to the town engineer. First hour's $170, and we're not charging anything. So
I may have missed this, but why is the single-family residential zoning permit so much more than a commercial permit?
I take care of a whole bunch of stuff.
Commercial uses for a permit would be like when, not to put you on the spot, but like when your husband moved from this location here to the next location, he had to come in and get a new zoning permit. It's just to make sure that that use complied with where he was moving to. Okay. So that would be a $50. But if they're building and it's a site plan approval, it is now $300.
Okay.
So that's thank just a simple clarifying. Moving into an established location.
Yeah. Got it. Thank you.
I'm just curious. Obviously, the Board of Education is considered one of exempt, right?
Yes, and
I was just reading it. I just
attached. Yes, right. So any town applications are exempt. If you go before the Wetlands Commission, at least when I was a Wetlands officer, you had to request that you didn't pay. I don't know if they're still doing that with town applications, or if you just don't take the money and go with it. We have not done that in the past. We possibly have to.
Okay, we don't need to take any action on this, do we?
No, as long as you're okay with that.
Yeah. Everybody good?
Who's that? Old fart.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marta. All right.
I know.
We're going to go to correspondence. And I'm going to group these. 12 ABC, Town of Preston, has some referrals. You all have it in your package, in your agenda. None of them have any effect on Montville. ABC, any questions from anyone? We have no action to take on them. Okay. And then number D, this Connecticut Siting Council. It's a tower on Chapel Hill Road in Montville.
It's been.
What do we want to say?
I mean, it's been before you multiple times when they applied, when they referred it out.
Right.
This is the final decision.
We're talking about the crazy tower. FYI. Yeah.
In all fairness, anybody have any questions on that? Okay, it's an FYI. We're all good. And there's no executive session this evening. Motion to adjourn.
Motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Again, thank you, everybody.
Yeah, thank you, staff. Here.